Hello, and welcome back to another episode of In Summation, The Final Word, a podcast for inquisitive minds on real-life courtroom drama. As always, I'm Paul Townsend, creator and host of this fine program. And today we turn to the show's bread and butter. The last few episodes, we talked about the Supreme Court's decision on whether abortion is a constitutional right in the civil defamation case, which was the tip of the iceberg sinking Alex Jones' InfoWars media empire. That's two civil cases in a row, which was a bit daunting and challenging. And I'd like to note that I appreciate the thoughtful responses I got to both episodes. I did receive more feedback on the abortion debate, but for the most part, everyone was extremely civil, even in disagreeing with me, which I appreciate. I'm always open to having my mind changed, and the best way to do that, whether it be for me or anyone else really, is to engage with what I said and explain why you disagree with it, rather than call me a knuckle-dragging bigot and assert that only a Neanderthal could possibly feel the way I do. And nobody really did that, so kudos to you, listeners. You've proven yourselves to be a very thoughtful, polite, and insightful group. I couldn't be more pleased. Also, I did get three or four messages from people who believed that I was a bit too hard on Alex Jones, that it appeared as though I had personal animus against him, which impacted how I viewed the case. As I frequently say, I tried very hard not to let my own feelings get in the way of giving you an unbiased analysis, but alas, I am human, and if it came across that way, then I'm sorry, it was not my intention. I will confess that I think Alex Jones to be basically without any redeeming qualities, but it was my intention to present that defamation case fairly on the law, and I stand by my position. But today, we sink back into the realm of murder, but in a nuanced way. At this point, we all basically know the mechanics, I think, of a typical murder case. There's a body, there's an investigation, there's a suspect. The suspect is arrested and charged. The prosecutor brings the case to trial, calls witnesses who testify either as to the things they saw, heard, felt, smelled, or tasted, or testifies as to some expertise or special knowledge they have, which is somehow relevant to the case. The prosecutor will also introduce evidence relevant to the question of guilt. Then the defense has the option to do the same. The parties deliver summations, and the jury will deliberate and reach a verdict. If the verdict's not guilty, the defendant goes home. If the verdict is guilty, the judge will impose a sentence. Now, it should come as no surprise to such an intelligent group of listeners such as yourselves that a key component of this process, from the prosecutor's point of view, is calling witnesses to the stand to testify as to what they saw, heard, felt, smelled, or tasted. These are what are called fact witnesses. They establish the conditions on the ground at the time of an alleged incident. Expert witnesses are often important, sometimes even more important, but fact witnesses are very different because when you're talking about expert witnesses, you usually can make a selection from a wide variety of potential experts. But you get stuck with fact witnesses because the unique knowledge those individuals contain isn't scientific or physical, mechanical, medical, or in any other learned field. It's firsthand knowledge of some sort about what actually happened. So one of the overarching questions of today's case is, what happens when an individual goes to trial, the district attorney puts on its case, defense does as well, the person is convicted, but then years, maybe even decades later, that conviction's overturned, and the case has to be retried. We see this happen from time to time. It usually gets some media attention. And sometimes when it was a big case to begin with, it becomes a huge deal on the retrial. Pundits break down the reasons for overturning the convictions. They debate whether the appellate court went too far in throwing something out, or whether the one piece of evidence, which maybe should not have been admitted, was significant enough to actually warrant vacating a conviction. Often, these are pretty interesting legal quandaries, but in a very real sense, the district attorney is presented with a rather difficult issue. If a conviction is obtained based on the strength of certain fact witnesses, but then that conviction is overturned 20 years later, can the DA just reintroduce that testimony at the new trial? Or are they required to track down all those people and bring them back? What if they don't remember at this point the way that they used to? What if they've passed away in those intervening years? What if certain physical evidence has been destroyed or lost? We're also going to discuss your constitutional right to confront witnesses against you, and what circumstances may arise where a person waives that right if they are the reason that the witness is not available to testify to begin with. Hold those questions in your mind as we work through today's case. On December 3rd, 1998, a woman named Julie Jensen was found dead in her bed by her husband in the Carroll Beach neighborhood of Pleasant Prairie, Wisconsin. It appeared initially to be a suicide. A toxicology screen revealed that she had ingested antifreeze. Witnesses immediately noted that the husband's behavior seemed a bit off. He didn't appear to be grieving all that much. He was laughing with friends at her funeral, and he immediately threw away all of her belongings and cleared out the house. Suspicions about these odd behaviors crystallized when it was revealed that shortly before she was found dead, Julie Jensen had given her neighbors a letter indicating that if anything were to happen to her, that she suspected her husband would be behind it. The letter wasn't the only piece of evidence introduced against the husband after he was arrested and brought to trial in 2008, but it was a huge focus of the prosecution when it was admitted into evidence over defense objections. He was convicted, sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. However, after several appeals, his conviction was vacated, and the appellate court ruled that the trial court erred in admitting the letter and said a new trial had to be conducted. The new trial took place earlier this year, 2023. So 15 years had passed since his initial conviction and 25 years since Julie Jensen's death. How did the passage of time affect the witnesses and evidence? Would the 15 years of incarceration impact the defendant's behavior at a new trial? Was ordering a new trial truly in the interest of justice in this case? Well, let's discuss. This is the State of Wisconsin versus Mark Jensen. Julie Jensen was initially Julie Griffin. She met Mark Jensen in 1981 while working in a Sears department store in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. At the time, they were both college students. They hit it off quickly and began dating, got married in 1984. Mark Jensen became a successful stockbroker, managing the Racine, Wisconsin office of a financial firm that was based in St. Louis, while Julie, who never ended up graduating college, worked a part-time job for the Port Authority in Chicago and took care of their two kids. Chicago is a little over an hour away from Pleasant Prairie, Wisconsin, where the Jensen family lived, and a lot of Julie's work did not require her to be present in Chicago at the time. There are two really important pieces of background information that you need to know about this case. The first is that Mark and Julie had two children, David and Douglas, and they both loved their children very much. The second is that in 1991, Julie Jensen had a brief affair, and Mark found out about it. They discussed it. Julie felt guilty. Mark felt betrayed. But they decided together that they would try and repair the relationship and move on. They both wanted to stay together for the kids and try to recover the relationship that they had. But despite Mark's efforts to put the affair behind him, over time, it ate at him. While he was still warm and caring towards David and Douglas, over the years, he became cold towards Julie, often ignoring or simply not responding to questions and spending increasing amounts of time in their home, in his office, on the internet. Mark's increasingly distant behavior began to make Julie suspicious and then flat out worried. She got so worried that she got in touch with the Pleasant Prairie Police Department. She spoke with Detectives Cosman and Ratzberg. She communicated her fear that her husband might do something to her, She left them voicemails indicating she was afraid of him. On December 3rd, 1998, Mark Jensen claimed that he found Julie unconscious in their bedroom. He called an ambulance, but by the time it arrived, she was already dead. She was laying face down in her pillows on her bed. During the three-week period leading up to her death, Julie had told several friends that her marriage was in the toilet. She was planning to file for divorce. She also told them that she believed that Mark would try to kill her, possibly with poison. She told several people that under no circumstances would she ever commit suicide. After her death, a toxicology examination was done on Julie Jensen's body, and it was determined that she died as a result of ethylene glycol poisoning. Ethylene glycol is the active ingredient in antifreeze. Testing on her stomach contents, kidneys, blood, and urine showed she received at least two doses, and that the final dose was administered shortly before her death, when she would have been either unconscious or basically too weak to move. The police didn't find any traces of antifreeze in the bedroom, the rest of the home, or even in the Jensen garage. Approximately 2 weeks prior to her death, Julie Jensen gave a sealed envelope to her neighbors, Thaddeus and Margaret Wout. Thaddeus went by Ted. She told Ted and Margaret that if anything happened to her, please give the envelope to Detective Cosman. Sure enough, the day that Julie Jensen was found dead, the Wouts provided the sealed envelope to Detective Cosman. Inside the envelope was a letter. This letter features prominently in the case, so we're going to read the whole thing verbatim. I took this picture, and I'm writing this on Sunday, 11/21/98 at 7 a.m. This list was in my husband's business daily planner, not meant for me to see. I don't know what it means, but if anything happens to me, he would be my first suspect. Our relationship has deteriorated to the polite superficial. I know he's never forgiven me for the brief affair I had with that creep 7 years ago. Mark lives for work and the kids. He's an avid surfer of the internet. Anyway, I do not smoke or drink. My mother was an alcoholic, so I limit my drinking to one or two a week. Mark wants me to drink more, with him, in the evenings. I don't. I would never take my life because of my kids. They are everything to me. I regularly take Tylenol and multivitamins. Occasionally take OTC stuff for colds, Zantac or Imodium. Have one prescription for migraine tablets, which Mark uses more than I. I pray I'm wrong and nothing happens, but I am suspicious of Mark's suspicious behaviors and fear for my early demise. However, I will not leave David and Douglas. My life's greatest love, accomplishment, and wish. My three D's. Daddy, Mark, David, and Douglas. So the Wouts have given the police this letter, and they've spoken to other neighbors and to the teacher of one of the Jensen children, who all confirmed that Julie Jensen said in no uncertain terms that she would never commit suicide and that she suspected Mark might do something to her. Still, the first autopsy conducted on Julie's body ruled the death a suicide. A search of Julie's personal computer revealed internet searches for suicide and poisoning, and specifically for ethylene glycol poisoning. The case then went to a toxicologist named Dr. Christopher Long. He characterized the antifreeze in Julie's gastric contents, meaning in her stomach, as a large concentration, and opined that at the time she ingested what would ultimately be the fatal dose, she could not have physically ingested that much antifreeze on her own. Law enforcement then conducted a search of Mark's computer, which showed that he was having an affair. Even so, it took over 3 years for the district attorney to charge Mark with Julie's death. They perceived what they had to be a string of circumstantial evidence without a real smoking gun. And the centerpiece of the evidence against Mark was this letter that the district attorney was concerned would be challenged on admissibility. In March 2002, Mark Jensen was arrested and charged with the first-degree intentional murder of Julie Jensen in Wisconsin State Court. In Wisconsin, felony prosecutions can proceed either by indictment of a grand jury or by preliminary hearing. We've talked a little bit about this process in past episodes, but just to refresh, there are two degrees of criminal actions. There are misdemeanors and there are felonies. Misdemeanors are considered relatively minor, while felonies are more serious. Each state has their own determination about what is a felony and how to classify them. In New York, we have Class A and Class B misdemeanors, while felonies range from Class A to Class E. And even Class A felonies have two subsections, Class A1 and Class A2. Some jurisdictions and some states will label misdemeanors as petty offenses and felonies as serious offenses. The language may change or vary a bit, but the underlying idea is the same in all 50 states. Our system is designed in such a way that a prosecutor cannot simply charge a person with a felony and go after them. There's an additional check for serious crimes, which involves either a judge or the public, to weigh in and make sure that the prosecutor is acting within the scope of what their evidence permits them to do. This is either done through a preliminary hearing or a grand jury. A preliminary hearing is an administrative process by which the prosecutor and defendant appear in front of a judge, and the prosecutor presents evidence to establish what's called a prima facie case, meaning that the prosecutor shows enough evidence to convince the judge that charging this person with this felony is not unreasonable or simply arbitrary. It does not require proof beyond a reasonable doubt. That standard is much lower because this stage isn't about guilt or innocence. It's about meeting a threshold to show that there's enough to move forward with the case. So it's not all of the evidence that the prosecutor has. It's a bare bones presentation of just enough that a judge is satisfied that the case should move forward. A grand jury, on the other hand, does not involve the judge at all. It's a group of members of the community who are summoned to the courthouse. In most states, it's between 17 and 23 people. The district attorney presents that same level of evidence, showing the grand jury that there's sufficient information so that these charges should go forward, and asks the grand jury to vote and agree. The defendant is not involved in the process unless he elects to testify. Neither the defendant nor the defense attorney sits in the grand jury when the rest of the evidence is shown to them. He doesn't have the ability to cross-examine witnesses, and he doesn't even know what the charges are until he receives an indictment. Mark Jensen had a preliminary hearing. At that hearing, the district attorney introduced the letter that Julie had written and given the votes 2 weeks before her death. Naturally, Jensen's defense team objected to the letter being admitted, but they were overruled. It became clear through the preliminary hearing that the major issue at the trial would be the admissibility of this letter. The conversations Julie had with the officers and with her friends and colleagues were hearsay. The prosecution could not have people testify as to what Julie had specifically told them, but the letter was analyzed differently. Let's take a moment to discuss a constitutional amendment which often gets overlooked in general society, but is exceptionally important in the criminal justice system, the Sixth Amendment. Amendment 6 guarantees the right to a speedy and public trial, to a trial by jury, access to the nature and cause of the charges against somebody, the right of a defendant to confront witnesses against him, the right to subpoena witnesses on his own behalf, and the right to the assistance of counsel. There's a lot packed into that amendment. Today, we're going to focus on the part of it which guarantees the person a right to confront the witnesses against him. From this stems the rule against hearsay, which is a constant source of confusion for both non-lawyers and lawyers alike. At essence, the problem with hearsay is that it introduces evidence which the defendant cannot adequately confront because the source of the information is not on the stand. Simply the person who heard the information and cannot actually testify as to its veracity. So the defendant is not afforded any opportunity to cross-examine on the topic of whether there's actual truth to the statement. Let's take a quick example to really make this clear. Let's say that Carper and Layla are having a conversation. Carper tells Layla that he personally saw Jared shoot Michael and kill him. Jared is ultimately arrested. The district attorney is putting him on trial and calling witnesses. What the district attorney can do is call Carper to testify that he personally saw Jared shooting Michael. What the district attorney cannot do is call Layla to testify that she heard from Carper that Carper personally saw Jared shoot Michael. In scenario one, where Carper is testifying, the defense attorney can question the veracity of what Carper is saying. Jared's lawyer can ask Carper where he was when he saw it. How far away was he? Was he wearing glasses? Does he have a prescription? How dark was it? Was it rainy? Does he know Jared personally? How long did he have to see him before the shooting? Does he have any bias against Jared unrelated to this case? And on and on and on. These questions will test the veracity of Carper's claim of personal knowledge and may demonstrate that Carper is indeed being honest, but it also may demonstrate that Carper is being dishonest, and a jury is entitled to weigh those credibility considerations. In scenario two, Layla may not be able to answer any of those questions about Carper. She may simply not know the answer, or even if she can provide an answer, it will again come from Carper, and the same ability to test the veracity presents itself. Hearsay, then, is the offering of a statement or testimony without the ability of the person against whom the statement is being offered to actually demonstrate that it may be false. Hence, we have a ban on hearsay evidence. But the ban on hearsay evidence is not absolute. There are a very limited set of circumstances in which hearsay can come into a trial record. And before we get into that, it's important to differentiate here between hearsay and non-hearsay statements. The same statement may seem hearsay, but still be admissible for a non-hearsay reason and can be considered only for that reason. Let's look at another example and then explain this a little further. Let's say Evan is on the witness stand and Jeff is on trial for the murder of Justin. Jeff is claiming self-defense. Evan is asked the question by Jeff's lawyer, "Did Jeff say anything to you the night of the incident?" And Evan responds, "Jeff told me he was terrified of Justin, that Justin had threatened him and told them that if he found him that night, Justin was going to kill him." Prosecutor objects and claims that this answer is hearsay and should be stricken from the record and the jury told to disregard. But the defense attorney here would respond that he's not offering the statement for the truth of the matter asserted. He's not making the statement to show that the words are actually true. Rather, he's offering that particular statement to demonstrate Jeff's state of mind on the night in question. And as his state of mind is a relevant consideration for self-defense, his mental state is a valid thing to bring to the jury's attention. At that point, the judge, if he's acting correctly, will instruct the jury that they can consider the statement as evidence of what Jeff's state of mind was, but they cannot consider it for the truth, i.e., they can't conclude based on this that Justin did indeed threaten Jeff's life. But in weighing whether Jeff reasonably believed he was acting in self-defense, they can use this statement in their deliberation on his thought processes. In that sense, the statement is not hearsay. What we are talking about is when actual hearsay statements may come in. This is very rare, but it can happen. A statement made by someone who is not testifying in court can be introduced in evidence as a factual statement under extremely limited circumstances. In this particular case, it boiled down to the question of whether the defendant, Mark Jensen, was the reason that the witness was unable to appear and testify about her firsthand knowledge. In a huge Supreme Court case in 2004, Crawford v. Washington, it was determined that statements could be admitted under a forfeiture by wrongdoing doctrine. The doctrine states that if the defendant is the reason that the witness is unable to come and testify him or herself, then the defendant does not get the benefit of not being able to confront the witness. You can't murder someone and then reap the reward of them not being able to testify as to your crime. It's a fairly logical doctrine, though it doesn't arise a lot because most murder victims don't write letters ahead of time saying, if I'm murdered, you need to investigate person X. This case, Crawford v. Washington, was decided while Mark Jensen's prosecution was still pending, and it became a hotly contested issue as the parties litigated the admissibility of Julie Jensen's letter. The special prosecutor assigned to the case, Robert Jambois, conceded that the voicemails left by Julie Jensen for the detectives were non-admissible hearsay. But he took the position, first, that the letter was non-testimonial and therefore wouldn't be hearsay. Remember that Jensen was arrested in 2002. Jensen's lead attorney, Craig Albee, argued that the letter was clearly hearsay and must be kept out. Here's how this particular issue played out at the trial court level. The trial court ruled initially the letter was admissible. After Crawford, Jensen moved for reconsideration. The trial court did reconsider and then decided under Crawford that the letter was now inadmissible because there was no opportunity to confront. They initially did not base their decision on the forfeiture by wrongdoing doctrine. The prosecutors appealed that decision directly to the Wisconsin State Supreme Court, and in February of 2007, that court ruled that if the state can prove by a preponderance of the evidence that the witness was unavailable because of the wrongdoing of Mark Jensen, then the letter could come in. So the case went back from the Wisconsin Supreme Court to the trial court for a hearing on the preponderance of evidence standard, and preponderance of evidence means 51%, more likely than not. It's far lower than beyond a reasonable doubt, which is the standard for guilt. So they had this hearing, and the trial court found that Jambois had met the standard and would be permitted to introduce the letter. The trial lasted around 6 weeks and took place more than 9 years after the death of Julie Jensen. Jambois' case was exactly what you would expect. It relied heavily on Julie Jensen's actions leading up to her death, and there was a main focus on that letter. The state also introduced evidence that Mark Jensen had been having an affair of his own with a woman named Kelly Labonte Greenman, who he married shortly after Julie's death. The jury heard that Mark was increasingly angry over the affair that Julie had had. The state also brought up that Mark had thrown away all of Julie's belongings immediately after her death and never really seemed all that upset or was never struck by grief. Jambois painted Julie as a devoted mother who would never have abandoned her children. Finally, the prosecution maintained that, as per the expert testimony, she could not have physically ingested the antifreeze by herself, given the physical condition at play. And therefore, they argued Mark Jensen had forced it on her and then suffocated her afterwards. The defense argued that Julie Jensen had simply committed suicide. This whole case was a witch hunt to persecute a grieving husband. Albee was able to show that Julie had been going to a doctor for depression in the time period leading up to her death. He argued that Julie had become angry at Mark for being distant and had decided to kill herself and make it look like he did it. This idea was later run with by author Gillian Flynn in the crime thriller Gone Girl. Flynn would claim that the story was actually based on the Scott Peterson case, which we previously covered on this program, but it actually more closely resembles the Jensen case, as argued by the defense. Albee also pointed out that despite Julie Jensen telling her neighbors that she had suspicions about her husband, she never called anyone on December 3rd, 1998, about Mark. and her own personal laptop had searches for antifreeze poisoning and suicide. After 6 weeks of testimony and evidence, the jury deliberated for about 30 hours before convicting Mark Jensen of first-degree intentional homicide. But that's not the end of our story. Around 4 months after the 2008 Jensen verdict, the Supreme Court decided another Confrontation Clause case, Giles v. California. The result was a narrower interpretation of the Confrontation Clause as it applied to the forfeiture by wrongdoing doctrine. Jensen filed an appeal claiming that based on the new guidelines established by Giles, admitting the letter into evidence violated the Confrontation Clause and his conviction needed to be vacated. Jensen's appeals went up through the Wisconsin State Supreme Court, but his conviction was affirmed through both the Appellate Division and the Court of Appeals. But Jensen was able to get his case into federal court, where a judge ultimately was more sympathetic to his arguments. Many times, once a defendant appeals to the Supreme Court or the final court of their state and loses, that's the end. They are consigned to serve their sentence unless there's either a change in the law or some bombshell new evidence is discovered which had previously been hidden. But there are some circumstances where a defendant can file a writ of habeas corpus and get their case heard in federal court. To do that, you need to raise what's called a federal question, meaning there has to be a federal constitutional issue with the case that the federal court then would have jurisdiction to hear. But Mark Jensen just happens to have a real constitutional issue. He claimed that introducing Julie's letter at his trial violated the Confrontation Clause of the Sixth Amendment. Thus, there is a federal constitutional issue, and the federal courts have jurisdiction to hear it. Had he merely claimed that a statement was introduced against him in error, that would be a state evidence question, and the federal court would have declined to hear it. But as this was a real federal constitutional issue, he got his case onto the docket of the Eastern District of Wisconsin. So what did Jensen argue? The ruling in Giles was that forfeiture by wrongdoing only applies when the wrongdoing is specifically intended to prevent someone from testifying. Meaning the prosecutor had to show that Mark Jensen's bad acts, which prevented Julie from testifying, were done specifically with the intention to prevent her from being able to take the witness stand. This the prosecutors could not do because their whole theory of the murder was that he wanted to kill her, not prevent her from testifying in a case that didn't originate until after she was already dead. So the federal court in Wisconsin agreed with Jensen. On appeal to the Seventh Circuit, the Federal Appellate Division sided with the Eastern District Judge, holding that admitting the letter in Jensen's case violated the Confrontation Clause under the ruling in Giles. They further ruled that the error was not harmless and was a significant factor in the conviction. The Wisconsin state prosecutors attempted to appeal this decision to the Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court declined to hear the case. So the Seventh Circuit's ruling stood and the conviction was vacated. The Seventh Circuit's decision was handed down in 2015. It's now been 17 years since Julie Jensen was killed in December 1998. Now, here's where this case actually gets pretty wild. Prosecutors decide in January of 2016 that they're going to retry Jensen and begin the process of getting everything ready all over again. Contacting witnesses, turning over discovery, writing motions. One of the motions filed by the prosecution team was a motion to reinstate the conviction. And on September 1st, 2017, Kenosha County Judge Chad Kirkman granted the state's motion and simply reinstated Mark Jensen's conviction and sentenced him to life without the possibility of parole. So Mark Jensen spent nearly two decades in appeals arguing over and over again, claiming that his trial wasn't fair, that his rights were violated, that he wasn't able to confront the maker of the most incriminating statements against him. At first, he's denied, then he's denied again, then he's denied in the Wisconsin Supreme Court, but then a federal court agrees with him, and then a federal appellate court agrees. And suddenly, Mark Jensen has hope that he might prevail at a second trial where the letter will be inadmissible. And then Judge Kirkman decides to reinstate the conviction, resentence him without a trial, and call it a day. Can you even imagine how crushing a blow that must have been to Jensen? But he again starts the process of going to the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, and this time he wins early. And by early, I mean he gets a decision on February 26th, 2020, reversing Judge Kirkman's decision and sending the case back for the new trial, which was initially demanded by the Seventh Circuit. It's now more than 21 years since Julie has died. So the Kenosha County District Attorney's Office is now in a bit of a difficult position. It's been a long time since Julie's passing. It's been a long time since Mark Jensen's initial trial took place. Amazingly, Bob Jambois handled the case for the prosecution for the entirety of the time it was pending, close to 2.5 decades. He was appointed as a special prosecutor when Mark Jensen was first arrested. He was at one point the Kenosha, Wisconsin County District Attorney, and he was reappointed to be the special prosecutor when the case was sent back for the new trial. Let's take a moment and just think about the massive logistical problems that prosecuting a case more than 2 decades after the event brings up. Many cases, including the Jensen case, require the testimony of fact witnesses. These people have to remember details about what happened, what they saw, what they heard, and they have to be credible. Often, memories fade with the passage of time. Events that were crystal clear a week, a month, 6 months, even a year after they occur may start to understandably get a little foggy 25 years later. It's just not realistic to think that a person's memory of an event taking place in 1998 is going to be perfectly reliable in 2023 when this retrial took place. And that's even if the event is a significant thing that sticks out in somebody's mind. 25 years is still 25 years. And that's an issue when you actually have the witness. What if a key witness moves away or dies or gets arrested themselves and is spending time in prison? Your witnesses may not be readily available. The significant passage of time may also affect physical evidence. Even though law enforcement is supposed to keep files intact throughout a defendant's appellate process, in case court ever vacates and orders a new trial, such as what happened here, that doesn't always happen. Files get lost over time. Fires and flooding destroy boxes in warehouses. Things get mislabeled and put in the wrong place or shipped to archives with poor tracking. The bottom line is stuff gets lost. And after 25 years, it would not be surprising at all to me to find out that the trial evidence or police reports, tox reports, autopsy reports, all that important information has been somehow misplaced. But before we launch into the arguments at the retrial without the letter, let's take a moment to talk about Bob Jambois. The Mark Jensen case was easily the biggest of his career. During his tenure as an assistant DA and then the DA of Kenosha County, he developed the reputation for being a real hothead. He would have outbursts in court, on the record. He would use insulting language when referring to defense attorneys. He frequently raised his voice to shout over defense attorneys and often over judges as well. There was a letter-writing campaign in a local newspaper where people called for his resignation over his abrasive and abusive courtroom behavior. One day, a young man pulled into his driveway there to pick up his daughter for a date. He honked the horn instead of getting out and knocking on the door. This was a mistake. Bob Jambois came out of the house and demanded that the boy pop the hood of his car. When the boy did, Jambois ripped the wires which connected the horn out of the car. He also then prosecuted the kid for driving without a valid license. There are many stories of Jambois losing his cool and using his official position to go after people he disfavored. But this is really the story of Mark Jensen, not Bob Jambois. Let's move to January 2023. Mark Jensen is put back on trial. Jambois' team has reassembled all their evidence and contacted all their witnesses and is ready to go. The first trial was a six-week affair with huge numbers of witnesses and evidence. The retrial was half that time, 3 weeks. Without the letter, Jambois was nervous he didn't really have a smoking gun. But here is what he did have for the second trial. He had that Mark Jensen never got over that Julie had had an affair. He had that Mark Jensen was also having an affair, and he had emails written to Kelly Labonte professing his love to her and disparaging his marriage and Julie. He had computer searches on Mark's computer for antifreeze poisoning. He had testimony from the Wotes and Ruth Vorwald, another neighbor, that Julie was concerned about Mark's behavior and was fearful for her safety. He had that Mark waited practically no time after Julie's death before throwing away all of her belongings and marrying Labonte. He had a jailhouse informant who testified that he was housed with Jensen, and Jensen had told him that he fed his wife juice with antifreeze, but that she wouldn't die fast enough, so he smothered her with a pillow. He had expert reports saying based on the amount of ethylene glycol in Julie's system, she would not have been physically able to consume the amounts necessary to cause her death. That was Jambois' case. And while Craig Albee was Jensen's lawyer for the first trial, in 2023, he was represented by Mackenzie Renner and Bridget Krause. They employed basically the same strategy and arguments that Albee had used during the first trial. They claimed that Julie was depressed, that her entire family suffered from mental illness. They said she had become increasingly paranoid and frantic. They claimed that she committed suicide and made it appear to be a homicide as a final act of revenge against Mark. Julie's doctor, Richard Borman, testified that he saw Julie days prior to her death and that she appeared depressed and upset. Dr. Borman said that Julie had become obsessed her family's history of mental illness. The defense also brought out that Julie's computer contained internet searches for suicide and antifreeze. But here's the thing. The defense was just too unbelievable to work. Jensen's lawyers claimed that Julie was suicidal and was also so vengeful that she staged the whole thing to look like Mark had killed her. So if you think about it, by presenting this argument, they're already admitting that it looks like Mark killed her. And as a defense attorney, that's not really the argument that I think you want to put in front of a jury. There was also a huge volume of testimony that Julie Jensen loved and was totally devoted to her children. The idea of her abandoning them is already a bit of a stretch, but to pile on that her intention was to effectively wipe both parents out of their lives just doesn't seem logical. Krause and Renner pushed hard on the idea that Julie had mental illness causing her to commit suicide, but there just wasn't good enough proof of that. They had Dr. Borman's testimony, but all he would commit to was that she seemed depressed and upset and was worried about her family's history of mental illness. He didn't diagnose her with any mental illness himself. Jensen's lawyers also really did not have an answer for Mark's odd behavior after Julie's death. Friends of Julie testified during her funeral, Mark was laughing with a group of friends as though he was at a cocktail party. He didn't appear to be grieving at all. He'd also purged the house of all of her stuff immediately and did not wait long to remarry the woman who he'd been having an affair with. Even without the infamous letter, there was sufficient evidence to convince the jury, who deliberated on the second trial just a few short hours, that Jensen had murdered his wife. He was sentenced again to life without the possibility of parole. In summation, Jambois and the prosecution team were fortunate that the fact pattern in this case was as extreme as it was. If this case had been a gang-on-gang homicide in 1998, remanded for a retrial in 2023, I think a jury would have had an easier time coming to a verdict of not guilty, and I think it would have been much harder for him to recreate the entire original file. But here we had a rich white man accused of basically brutally torturing and killing his wife in a painful and heinous way. And Jensen was the opposite of a sympathetic defendant. He was instantly unlikable. And each witness who testified painted a picture of Julie Jensen as a model mother, neighbor, employee, a bright light in a dark world. When you're forced to defend a supremely unlikable person, there are strategies lawyers employ to try and shift the jury's focus away from that. One thing I would typically not recommend, because it's incredibly difficult to pull off effectively, is to launch a total smear campaign on the victim. Usually the lawyers come off looking very badly when they try and do this. It's seen by juries as a tacit acknowledgement that their client is a monster, and the lawyer is just engaging in whataboutism. Yes, my client was laughing at her funeral, but she was so consumed by vengeance that she killed herself and tried to use that to send him to jail forever. You lose a lot of credibility with the jury if you don't pull it off perfectly. There were things that Jensen could have done here to help himself. He could have, and I think should have, made a much more serious attempt to rehabilitate his own character. Both of his sons ultimately wrote letters of support for him to the judge. He should have found a way to elicit testimony that he was a good father who loved and took care of his sons. He should have found some positive things he did, either in the community or at work, put on some character witnesses to try and wipe away some of the mud that had been flung on him. If the jury despises the defendant, it makes it very difficult for them to acquit him. Even shaky evidence can lead to a conviction if the jury can't stand the guy in the chair. But conversely, if a defendant is sympathetic, if the jury feels for him, they're less likely to give weight even to strong evidence and will seek ways to justify acquitting criminal behavior. Now let's talk confrontation clause. Was the Seventh Circuit right to invalidate the conviction, throw the letter out? Does that decision sit right with you? Or does it kind of nag at you a bit, make you feel a bit uncomfortable? When the Supreme Court ruled in the Giles case, it severely limited the scope of situations where forfeiture by wrongdoing applied. If you kill someone because you want them dead, then a letter they wrote immediately before their death about how, if they die, you should be the top suspect is inadmissible. If you kill someone to prevent them from testifying against you, then it comes in. We spend a lot of time, both in this podcast and in society, discussing the rights that defendants have, due process rights. These rights prevent the awesome power of the state or federal government from steamrolling criminal defendants. But one thing we sometimes overlook is that the state has due process rights also. A fundamentally fair trial goes both ways. As a former prosecutor, I completely understand the position that if you are the direct cause of someone not being able to testify using some nefarious tactics, you shouldn't get the benefit of precluding what that person would have said. How is that fair to the victim? How is that fair to the state's case? And how do we even dive into a defendant's mind and ascertain why they did whatever it was that they did? How do we know whether or not it was to prevent somebody from testifying? On the other hand, a defendant really is at a disadvantage when a letter like Julie Jensen's comes into evidence because you can't explore anything at all about the letter itself. Maybe she did write it while going through a suicidal psychotic break or while impaired by alcohol or drugs, or maybe she didn't even write it at all. Someone else did. One of the important features of a trial is that it offers a way to test the weight and the character of evidence through examination and cross-examination. When you remove the ability to means-test evidence, you begin to run the risk of convicting people based on inaccurate information. In my opinion, the Seventh Circuit got this one right and the original Wisconsin trial court made a mistake by admitting Julie Jensen's letter. Now, hear me out before you fire off emails to me saying I'm promoting bad behavior to cover people's tracks. This is a constitutional issue. It is directly addressed in the Bill of Rights. It's a fundamental tenet of our justice system that a criminal defendant has the right to confront an accuser. That right does not vanish upon the unavailability of the witness, even if the defendant is the reason the witness is not available. I understand the policy arguments against it. I get them. And as a former prosecutor, I am acutely aware of the application of this rule. But this letter constituted testimony. It was akin to Julie Jensen taking the stand and testifying that if something happens to me, you should look first at Mark because I think he is going to kill me, and then allowing her to walk off the stand without being cross-examined. The chances are simply too high that there could be some serious flaws with evidence presented in this way that can't be exposed. The only way to ensure that doesn't happen is to exclude the potentially erroneous evidence. Now, you can call me a defense attorney hack if you'd like, but trials are about getting to the truth, the facts of what happened. Admitting untested evidence can easily set that off track. And even without the letter, the 2023 jury convicted Jensen in far less time than the 2008 jury. So that is the show on Mark Jensen, the Confrontation Clause, and retrying cases decades later. A special thank you to Eric Stipe, who edited today's episode. If you'd like to get in touch with me to suggest a topic or a case, or if you just want to send me a message unrelated to the show, please email me at insummationpodcast@gmail.com. You can also tweet me at insummationpod. I'm on Instagram at insummation. You can check out the show's website, insummation.com, or the show's Facebook page. You can also look me up the old-fashioned way on my law firm's website, robertcgottlieblaw.com. As always, I appreciate the thoughtful messages I get and the discussions that they generate. And if you disagree with me, you're always free to let me know what you think and why, and maybe you'll change my mind. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the show. And if you rate and review it, it'll help other people find it as well. If you're new, please feel free to check out our entire prior catalog. And as always, thanks so much for stopping by. And I hope that you'll come back for more.